From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, just in time for summer vacation, we hear from intrepid travel writers about the danger, thrills, and discomforts of travel adventures. The late Bruce Chatwin gave up a steady job to wander the earth and write about what he saw. We'll feature a 1987 interview with him. Tracy Johnston knew she'd face difficulties when she went down Borneo's most treacherous river, but she got even more than she bargained for as she endured floods, foot rot, sweat-eating bees, and leeches. Tim Cahill tells us about how he nearly blew it in the desert. And in case these travel mishaps inspire you to roam far from home, Paul Theroux has some advice about how to keep your distance from the parasites and other bugs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Leaders of the world's seven richest nations have opened their summit in Naples, Italy. President Clinton says the group will spend the next few days discussing ways to stimulate job creation in Canada and European countries. Their economies have started to grow after being stagnant for several years. The president will also push a plan to provide alternative energy sources for Ukraine if that country shuts down the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Mr. Clinton also held a Get Acquainted meeting at the summit today with new Japanese Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama. Both men are trying to reassure investors about the dollar's stability against the yen. President Clinton was also encouraged by today's unemployment report, which shows the jobless rate was steady last month at 6%. He also says there's little chance for a rate hike because inflation is not a factor.
And the real key is the economy generating real, genuine, substantiated fears of inflation? And the answer to that is no. If you look at the wage levels and the other indicators, we're having a growth with low inflation, really for the first time in 30 years, an investment-led growth. We're leading our partners in the rate of investment and the rate of productivity growth and the rate of export increase. And I think we ought to keep it on that track. I don't think we should reverse course.
Mr. Clinton also says the G7 nations should go on pursuing growth without inflation. He says the trade imbalance with Japan will right itself, and so will the dollar. Panamanian officials are accusing the United States of bargaining in bad faith over the issue of Haitian refugees. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
The political fallout following the announcement by Panamanian President Guillermo Endara that Haitian refugees would not be granted safe haven in Panama continues to spread, with high-ranking Panamanian government officials claiming that the United States bargained in bad faith. According to Foreign Minister Jose Molino, the White House knew in advance that his government would not allow the refugees to stay on U.S. military bases in the Canal Zone. Molino insisted that the agreement reached with Washington specified that the Haitians would be housed in a refugee camp in Panama under the supervision of the United Nations. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
The only Branch Davidian to testify against fellow sect members in a federal trial has been sentenced to prison. Catherine Schroeder has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for her role in a gun battle at the group's estate last year. She apologized for what happened before her sentence. Schroeder could have been sentenced to 10 years in jail. The Branch Davidians held off federal authorities for 51 days last year before their compound burned to the ground. Leader David Koresh and about 80 followers inside died during the blaze. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 12 points at 3,701. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The Securities and Exchange Commission is being asked to investigate whether a former Federal Reserve governor sold confidential central bank information for profit. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
House Banking Committee Chairman Henry Gonzalez wants the SEC to expand on the Inspector General's probe of former Fed Governor Wayne Angel. Angel left the Fed in February and later joined the New York investment firm of Bear Stearns as chief economist. Shortly after leaving the Fed, Angel reportedly gave clients key information about interest rates that he may have learned at the central bank. The New York Times report, which prompted the Fed probe, said Angel told clients that most of the Fed's 12 regional banks had filed requests to raise the discount rate that the Fed charges for overnight loans. A few weeks later, the Fed did raise the discount rate, but Angel told the Times his prediction was an educated guess. Gonzalez says he wants to know what Angel told clients and if the information was used by them for securities trading. Angel has not commented on the issue. Gonzalez has asked SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt to keep the Banking Committee informed of any actions it takes in the case. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Space Shuttle Columbia is now in orbit. The shuttle was launched on time despite some worries about bad weather. Six Americans and one Japanese make up the crew. They'll conduct a variety of science experiments, including tests involving thousands of fish. The scientists are aboard the Columbia shuttle, which is NASA's oldest shuttle. U.S. mail service in the nation's capital is the worst in the country. A survey taken by accounting firm Price Waterhouse says only 60% of first-class letters sent to addresses in Washington, D.C. arrived on time in the first part of the year. That's well below the national average of 78%. Long Beach, California had the best performance with 89% on-time delivery. The survey was submitted to the Postal Service. The Business Mailers Review obtained the raw data and did the rankings. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I don't know what your travel plans are for the summer, but I can guarantee you that mine aren't as ambitious or as dangerous as the trips we're going to hear about. On this archive edition of the show, we're featuring intrepid travel writers. We begin with a 1987 interview from the archives with the late British novelist and travel writer Bruce Chatwin. English writer Andrew Harvey once wrote in the New York Times, "Nearly every writer of my generation in England wanted at some point to be Bruce Chatwin. From Mr. Chatwin, we learned to dare to be obsessive, irregular, learned, exotic." Chatwin's 1977 book, In Patagonia, about his solitary journey through South America, brought him instant recognition. His travels also took him through Iran, Afghanistan, China, and the Soviet Union. Chatwin died in 1989 at the age of 48 from a rare bone disease. He had made a vocation out of his restlessness. In 1987, I asked what made him so restless.
I suspect that everything is supposed to happen to you before the age of three. Anyway, I was brought up wandering around wartime England in that very, very highly charged atmosphere. I was born in 1940. My first recollections are of the Battle of Alamein, of hearing Winston Churchill coming through one of those brown plastic radios and then dancing around with my mother. I was hanging onto my grandmother's legs and her stockings fell down. I deeply remember. That's one of my first recollections. But we lived out of a suitcase. All my early recollections are of, kit bags coming through windows, blackouts, and all those kind of exciting things. And we went from one set of rented rooms to another, all through wartime England. And when we then settled down after the war in those rather grim post-war years in a house for the first time, it wasn't much of a house because we had no money, I associated settlement with some kind of terrible depression. And I think whenever I've got holed up, as it were, then my way of solving my particular crises is to move.
Well, you spent part of your early adulthood working at Sotheby's, the famous art auction house.
Yeah.
And I think you directed the Impressionism department for a while.
Roughly, yes.
But
there were others.
You gave up that life. You had a very good position.
Oh, yes.
What was there a turning point for you where you decided to give up a regular working job and to ditch it all so you could go travel?
Well, put it this way. My mother, when I left school, I wanted to travel in Africa. My mother didn't actually like the idea. My parents didn't quite like the idea of their 18-year-old son sort of dashing around Africa, but they sort of said, well, okay, fine. You could go and work in Sotheby's as a porter for a little while, and then if you don't like it, then you can go. But just sort of give it a try. So I went and I worked as a porter, and then I became a kind of instant expert. Those were the days in the art business when nobody seemed to know very much. Within a matter of no time, I was pronouncing with sort of insufferable arrogance on the authenticity of paintings, whether they were genuine or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, I had this career in the art business. But then I got a kind of psychosomatic eye complaint. My right eye went rather funny. And the eye surgeon to whom I went in London said, Bruce, I think you've been looking too closely at pictures. There's nothing wrong with you organically. Why don't you swap them for some long horizons? Where would you like to go? So I said Africa, which was the place which I'd somehow been prevented from going to before. So I went to Africa, and then I saw nomad peoples for the first time, and I felt it was quite wonderful the way in which my travelling companions had this immense pride in having nothing, whereas our pride, or my particular pride up till then, had been towards accumulation of things and everything else.
Had you been collecting a lot of art?
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful group of things, even bought on a shoestring, but I had things which would today be worth I don't know what.
You say that in the past tense. Did you decide to sell off your collection?
Yeah, they all got flogged off to in order to pay for journeys one way or another, and I don't regret them. One or two things I do regret, rather, yes.
So you were willing to throw off your collection and your possessions so you'd be freer to travel?
Absolutely, yes. The two work against each other.
I want to quote something that you say in your book. You say psychiatrists, politicians, tyrants are forever warning us that the wandering life is an aberrant form of behavior, a sickness which, in the interest of civilization, must be suppressed. Was that attitude the one that was around you when you decided to travel? Were you discouraged
from really
traveling?
They thought it was a bit of madness, but they always knew. I suppose my friends and family knew that I was. I like to be kind of professionally unavailable. Of course, that is kind of unacceptable if you're in business. You have to be somewhere on the end of the telephone. You have to make contact. And it seems to me to be one of the great luxuries of the 20th century is if you can be, you can make yourself unavailable. I think that's the greatest luxury I can think of.
What do you mean, like getting away from the telephone?
Yes, absolutely. Out of touch. That's the situation I like to be in.
Why do you want to be out of touch?
I just don't want. I don't want to be bothered. If I'm writing a book or whatever, you know, you have to have your head free from all those sort of other things that get to you. Otherwise, you get sort of lured back into the web.
Well, most of us, when we travel, take suitcases of clothes and books, and I know some people who even take television sets and video cassette recorders so they can catch up on movies when
God
they're traveling.
God help them, yes. God help them.
Do you travel light?
Oh, absolutely. I have a little sort of rucksack. This is, I suppose, a bit of a show-off remark, but the great and wonderful French actor Jean-Louis Barrault was somebody I met. I met him on a plane, and he had at his feet the most beautiful leather rucksack, very, very small. I mean, tiny, really tiny. And I asked him about it, and he said, I've got an apartment in Paris. I live there with my wife and everything else. But actually, this object, which I bought to go on a walking tour when I was 16 in the Tyrol in the 30s, is my home. And I have to say that I copied that, and I took a look at it, and I even found a piece of sort of string, and we sort of measured how much it was and where the pocket fitted on this thing, actually on the plane. He then went off and he said, no, sure, of course you do that. And I had one made, and it's a kind of pillow, comforter. There's a slot in the side for a bottle. When I went to Patagonia, I put a half bottle of rather good champagne in the pocket for the worst possible moment. And otherwise, I really take nothing, hardly anything in it, just a change of warm clothes, and I'm off. And one watches, if you go into those wild places, you watch, very often you find expeditions of university expedition to this and that, with a lot of very bad-tempered people all looking around a Land Rover which has got stuck in the dust or the mud, and I must say I'm thankful for my little rucksack that enables me to go on to the next thing.
I love this idea of having a little bottle of champagne for the worst possible moment. What was the occasion for actually drinking it?
In Tierra del Fuego, which is one of the most sort of grisly, but it isn't so cold, but it's pretty wet. There's a constant storm going, a constant rainstorm. And I did, I was crossing one of those kind of corrugated paths of logs across a swamp, and one of the logs got dislodged, and I went in. I never thought that I'd actually come out again, this glutinous black mud, and covered from head to foot, quite cold, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. That is the moment when I sat down and drank my half bottle.
Did it taste good?
Delicious. Krug is an excellent mark.
Okay. You know, I called you, Bruce Chatwin, a travel writer earlier, and I wasn't sure if you'd bristle at that.
I'll say expression. I'm bristling now, yes. I don't see the meaning of it. I don't quite get the meaning of it. After all, the word travel, let's face it, what does travel really mean? It's the same word as the French travail. It means work. And any writing is work, and so it's a form of traveling anyway. And I was brought up to the notion that I think it's something to do with if you live on little islands like we have to, that what I forget who said that England was that tight little island. You know, I think it was some sort of American wit during the war. And if you live there, you have two options. Either you enter into that rather closed hermetical system, or else you just treat the world as your back door. And I rather hope to do that. I just looked at the map and thought looked at the atlases when I was a child and thought this is where I'm at home. And I don't necessarily see the great virtue of this word travel.
That was the late travel writer Bruce Chatwin. He died in 1989 of a rare bone disease. He was 48. Our interview was recorded in 1987. More about travel and adventure after this break. This is Fresh Air. Talk about your basic midlife crisis. Tracy Johnston was on an expedition down the wildest river in Borneo when she had her first menopausal hot flashes. We'll save the hot flashes for another time. Johnston is a journalist who was invited by the Sobek Adventure Travel Company to participate in the first descent down Borneo's Bow River. The company hoped to open the river to commercial rafting. The river has an 18-mile section that funnels through a steep, narrow gorge. Local guides said the rapids in the gorge were unrunnable. No one had done it before. As the team was about to start the run, a woman from a Borneo village said a prayer for the misguided white people who were going to die in the gorge. Everyone survived, but they weren't very comfortable. In Johnston's book, Shooting the Bow, she gave a little inventory of her physical problems.
This is basically what happens to you if you have to spend any amount of time at all in a rainforest. Before I went to sleep, I made a written inventory of my physical condition. Feet, covered with red spots, particularly under my left arch, dark red sores between my toes with stinging, broken skin, foot rot arrested, but not gone. Ankles, right ankle swollen for some reason, left ankle has an open sore on it, have to beg for some antiseptic. Legs, four dark bruises on my left leg and a huge welt behind the knee, a spider bite. Two dark bruises and a bump and gash on my right shin, plus a line of poison something on my calf, oozing and itching like crazy. Arms. A new rash on my right arm. Hope it isn't the same poison thing. Two immense bites, one on each arm, still swollen, about 2 inches. Hands. A splinter festering in my thumb, 8 fingernails broken. Mouth. The sore on my gum, neither better nor worse. Mind. Mildewed, lethargic, maybe rotten. Heart, love you, John.
And John is your husband.
John's my husband, yeah.
Who was at home wondering why the heck you were on this voyage in the first place.
He was.
Well, I spoke to Tracy Johnston in 1993 and asked her what she expected when she signed up for this expedition down the Bow River in Borneo.
I thought it was going to be a modest adventure. I knew it was an exploratory river trip and that the river had never been run before. Which meant that there might be some surprises. On the other hand, I had read the catalog, the Sobek catalog, which described the trip as of average difficulty. So that kind of clung on to that description. You know, average, certainly I could handle.
Was it of average difficulty?
Well, let's just say, that Sobek is not offering the trip anymore. It was really, we were one emergency away from disaster. I'd say.
What is the river like, the Bow River in Borneo?
Well, the Borneo is right in the equator, and there's really primary tropical hardwood rainforest all around it. And the part that we were going through was a 20-mile section called the Bow River Gorge, and it was surrounded by steep rock walls on both sides. And the water there, I don't know why we didn't really know this. I guess because we didn't have time to scout it. The water was really almost one continuous journey of white water, frothing white water. It was very damp and humid and fetid in the gorge like it is in any rainforest. And also we found out what happens to rivers in a rainforest when it rains. There's no soil really on the ground, and so all of the water just pours right into the river off the gorge and off all the mountains. And in fact, there was one time when we were really in quite a desperate situation because the river was beginning to flood. It rose about 2 feet in 10 minutes, and we realized we have to find a place to get out, to get up to high ground, and that wasn't always possible on this river. Now, luckily, at that point, we did, and then the story of what happened to the river when it flooded is another amazing story, but the river really did become a kind of personality on the trip, as does the rainforest.
Now, you describe yourself as the oldest and the weakest person on this trip. What did it mean to be the oldest and the weakest?
Well, the oldest meant being over 40. The weakest meant, not sure I was the weakest, but I did have a bad back problem. In fact, for the first time in my life, my back had been thrown out and about 2 weeks before the trip. And so I knew that I had to, especially when we got in this dangerous situation in the gorge, I knew that I had to do anything to keep myself in good shape. The worst thing would have been to have somebody who, like, couldn't move, had a bad back.
We should mention the bursitis, too, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Right. Yes, I've done a lot of traveling and slept on a lot of hard floors and a lot of rocks, but I've always had an air mattress because I do have this bursitis in my hips, and it just hurts to sleep on my side. And because of this back problem, I couldn't sleep in my back. So yes, I was, as you know, I was inordinately worried about an air mattress. You know, I'm sure now that I think of it, I could have made it without an air mattress. I did learn from this trip that you can withstand a lot of things that are not comfortable, more than you would imagine, actually.
Had I known you when you were setting out on this voyage, I would have told you it was really stupid to go with a bad back and bursitis.
Well, my husband told me it was stupid to go, but then he doesn't really quite understand the flirtation with real adventure that I have. Would you understand that? I mean, do you understand
why
somebody...
Try me. Go into it a little bit.
Well, I had been on one river trip before where I had been dumped in the water and realized that I was at the mercy of the river and had almost died. And, you know, my husband said to me, you know, 8 years ago you did that, and now you're telling me you have a good idea. You want to go on another river trip. But all I could tell him is in uncomfortable situations or dangerous situations, I find that I can almost transcend myself. You know, life gets very simple. And as, you know, as happened to us, if we happen to find a package of instant mashed potatoes at the bottom of a food bag and you eat it and it tastes fabulous and you realize, my God, you know, all I need is something great in my mouth and I'm happy, you know, no matter how many bugs are biting me or how many bees are swirling around me. Or you take a bath one night in a warm river with a bar of soap and the moonlight on you and you kind of are really feeling things and seeing things in a new way that you almost get transformed. And then that brings me, I guess, to what happened on this trip, where it really did become quite an adventure. We knew we were in a dangerous situation. We knew we were in a part of the world where practically maybe 10 human beings had ever been in the history of mankind. And there's kind of an adrenaline rush that comes from that. And, I don't like terror, I guess, but I kept thinking of the poem Leda and the Swan, that, you know, there's some dark force and you're getting close to it, whether it's death or whether it's the evil three-headed river spirit that the Dyaks believed were in the gorge, whether it's just adrenaline or not. But it's kind of the closest I can come to being really transported into a new life.
The kind of thing I wonder about, because you asked me if I understood this, you know, if I understood mm-hmm. this kind of desire for adventure. Well, what I wonder is when you're there and you're facing the terror and you're risking your life, do you ever ask yourself, well, what am I risking it for? I mean, it's this journey that I'm going to write a magazine article about. Okay, it turned into a book. But, I mean, do you know what I mean? You're not there to save lives. You're not there to, like, defend your country or even defend your family. You're there just for the sake of it, you know? And so when you're facing your own death just for an adventure that has no point beyond adventure, what do you tell yourself?
Well, I know what I tell myself. There was actually only one point in the trip where I thought I was going to die, and that was again when I the boats had overturned, and I was really trapped at the bottom of a waterfall, and I was just held there, held in place, out of breath, gulping air, and I know exactly what I thought. It was exactly the same thing that you said. Oh, you know, God, I'm going to die because of this stupid river trip. But then the rest of the time, I didn't feel that I was going to die. I mean, there wasn't terror. We were trying to make our way out of the canyon. It was uncomfortable. But I was cautious. I was never in a situation in which I wasn't in control in terms of just walking, traversing the river, and whatnot. But yes, I agree. I thought that very thing, you know. Oh, you know, this is really, really dumb.
So
you know, forget it, I guess, like childbirth or something. You just forget it.
So when you were saved from that near-death experience, was there something very exhilarating about realizing, well, false alarm, I'm not going to die?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, what's that feeling like of being saved from death on this adventure?
Oh, well, it was amazing for me. I met up with Sylvie, the French woman who was in the boat with me, and she had had the same experience and was basically just kind of was mad and was worried and was complaining, and I just found that I had this big smile on my face. I just still felt exhilarated, I guess. It was like soldiers coming home or something. On the other hand, that swim, that initial swim, which happened the first day of the trip, did do something that I really didn't like for the entire rest of the trip, and that was that it made me scared. I was, for the first time, I was really scared of whitewater. I had thought, naively, I guess, that because we were making this trip with really world-class river guides, and they were handling the boats, and all I had to do was hang on and bail, I thought it would be like riding on the shoulders of a competition skier or something. I would get taken down this river in incredible style, but I would be safe. And what I realized is that if the boats flip and I'm in the water, no matter how good the guides are, it doesn't make any difference. You know, I was on my own.
Tracy Johnston, recorded in 1993. Her book Shooting the Bow is now in its 8th printing. Johnston recently returned from Africa, where she was doing research for a new book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We have more travel adventures in the second part of our show. Here's Noel Coward singing his great travel song, Sail Away.
When the storm clouds are riding through a winter sky, sail away, sail away. When the love light is fading in your sweetheart's eye, sail away, sail away. When you feel your song is orchestrated wrong, why should you prolong your stay? When the wind and the weather blow your dreams sky high, sail away, sail away, sail away. Love is meant to make us glad. Love can make the world go round. Love can drive you raving mad, torment and upset you. Love can give your heart a jolt, but philosophers have found that it's wise to do a boat when it starts to get you down. When your life seems too difficult to rise above, sail away, sail away. When your heart...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We don't want to put a damper on your vacation, but coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, some world travel adventures not for the squeamish. We talk with travel writer Paul Theroux about the subject he leaves out of his travel books, the insects and parasites that have afflicted him with fevers, boils, the runs, and other awful things. And we'll talk with Tim Cahill, who's been described as a cross between Hunter Thompson and John McPhee. His adventures swimming with sharks and wandering Death Valley have produced some humorous and self-deprecating travel stories. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The annual G7 Economic Summit is underway in Naples, Italy. Before the opening session, President Clinton received assurance from Japan's new prime minister that his government will work to keep Japan's markets open to foreign trade. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Naples.
President Clinton comes to the G7 meetings with the American economy in a strong position. It's generating more growth and jobs than the other G7 nations. At past summits, the U.S. has been criticized for its huge budget deficits. This time, the president can boast that as a percentage of its total economy, the U.S. budget deficit is among the lowest in the G7. But there are still problems here for Mr. Clinton. The U.S. dollar is slumping against the Japanese yen, and the president has had to work hard to convince currency markets that the U.S. wasn't letting the dollar drop in order to make its goods more competitive abroad.
The United States does not seek to grow its economy or change its trade balance through a low dollar. We do not want that.
The president tried to focus attention away from the dollar's problems. Let us not lose sight of the real economy where people live, he said. And in that economy, we've had a year of strong growth without inflation. In Naples, I'm Mara Liasson.
The government says the nation's unemployment rate was unchanged in June and remained at 6%. But the Labor Department says the nation's non-farm payroll swelled by 379,000. That's far more than economists had expected. Analysts say the report means the economy is still expanding and at a robust clip. Economists say investors may become worried that growing employment will fuel inflation and decrease the value of their holdings. The space shuttle Columbia blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center today on a two-week mission. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA's oldest shuttle left its launch pad and roared into space amid a backdrop of puffy and wispy scattered clouds that had earlier threatened to postpone today's main event. Shuttle Commander Robert Cabana will park Columbia in an orbit approximately 180 miles high. From there, the crew will activate the International Microgravity Laboratory inside the Space Lab module in Columbia's cargo bay. For the next 2 weeks, the crew will work in two shifts, around the clock, conducting life sciences research on each other and looking for new ways to process different materials. A large contingent of Japanese media witnessed today's launch. On board Columbia is the first Japanese woman to fly into space aboard the shuttle. Payload specialist Chaki Mukai is a cardiovascular surgeon and will aid in the medical research. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Fierce wildfires are still burning in several western states. The worst blaze near Glenwood Springs, Colorado, is still out of control. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow gained 20 points to close at 3709. Losings, or rather losers, led advancers. This is NPR. U.S. and North Korean officials have wrapped up their first session of talks in Geneva on resolving the dispute over North Korea's nuclear program. North Korean officials called the round productive. The BBC's Charles Scanlon has details.
For most of the past year, the United States has insisted that North Korea reveal its past nuclear secrets to find out whether it's already extracted enough plutonium to make a nuclear bomb. North Korea has always rejected those inquiries, preparing to risk economic sanctions rather than open up two secret nuclear waste dumps thought to hold the evidence. But now the Americans appear to be concentrating on restricting North Korea's current and future nuclear plans. The American calculation appears to be that once North Korea starts down the road to nuclear transparency, all will be revealed in the end. On offer to the North Koreans, if that happens, are diplomatic relations and help from the Americans in acquiring more modern nuclear reactors, which produce less bomb-making fuel than North Korea's current installation.
Carl Scanlon reporting. Japan will support economic sanctions if needed against North Korea. A senior U.S. official told the Associated Press that new Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama has made clear Tokyo will support whatever action is needed against North Korea. Murayama Socialist Party has close ties with North Korea, which is governed by communists. A federal appeals court says a lesbian colonel won't have to wait to return to the service. The court has rejected a government request to delay Margareth Kammermeier's reinstatement. The Justice Department had asked for the delay pending an appeal of her case or until the court rules in a similar case pending against sailor Keith Meinhold. The government could appeal the Kammermeier case again to the Supreme Court. Kammermeier is a highly decorated Army nurse with 26 years in uniform. She was discharged from the military 2 years ago because of her sexual orientation. She's been ordered reinstated on grounds the discharge was discriminatory. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our archive show today features adventurous travel writers. Action and adventure without the gratuitous chest-pounding is how Tim Cahill has described his writing. Most of his articles are self-deprecating accounts of his death-defying experiences around the world in caves, mountains, deserts, rapids, and the deep sea. Cahill writes for Rolling Stone magazine and Outside magazine. His travel collections include A Wolverine is Eating My Leg and Jaguars Ripped My Flesh. These were the in-house generic titles his editors at Outside Magazine gave his pieces. He once wrote that the next time an interviewer asked him why he takes so many risks, he would tell them, "Risk is a form of therapy." In 1989, I asked him to explain why he found risk therapeutic.
I wrote a book a few years back. It took me called Buried Dreams, and it was an intense look at the psychological maneuverings of a serial killer named John Wayne Gacy, who was convicted of murdering more people than anyone else in American history. After 100 hours of interviews and 3.5 years of working on the thing, I found myself obsessed with the human evil. I found the idea of one more morbid detail was going to send me screaming around the bend. And when I felt myself reach that point, I thought, why don't I go out and risk my life for no very good reason? And I'll tell you what happens. It's true. If you are obsessed with the problem of human evil and you find yourself sleeping badly, looking at people on the street and saying, that's a potential victim, very, very unhealthy ways to think, and you arrange to go diving with sharks in 2 weeks, As 1 week passes, you begin thinking a little bit more about the sharks and a little bit less about the human evil. The day before you get in the water with those sharks, I guarantee you, you are not going to think about anything but sharks. And while you're in the water, there is no thinking. No thinking in the usual sense. You have to act deftly. The sharks are all around you, 360 degrees. You must be very aware and very conscious. And then, when you get out of the water, you find that that focus, that intense focus that you've had on those sharks and on acting deftly has resolved itself into a kind of a euphoria that is a very intense relaxation. I think that you can literally put your life on the line in order to save your soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see what you're saying, although it's not the therapy I would would choose for myself, but
it's not
what you're saying I comprehend.
But not everyone needs to do this kind of therapy. What I'm talking about is very akin to Oriental meditation techniques. Some people can do this sitting cross-legged in a room on a pillow. Others of us need a little harder bump.
Well, I have to ask you about your experiences in Death Valley, and this goes back a few years, and there's an article about this in your new book, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. And you went to, what was your goal here in going to Death Valley? You were going from the lowest point to the highest point in the continent, was that it?
Yeah, some people understand that instinctively. I noticed looking at the map that in the continental United States, the lowest point is Death Valley, 282 feet below sea level. The highest point is Mount Whitney, about 15,000 feet, a little under. And these places are separated by about 100 miles. Why not walk between them? But I ran into some problems because there were some things I didn't understand about the desert.
Like what?
Well,
yeah, the problems were that you nearly died in the desert. But we'll get to that a little bit later. What didn't you understand?
I nearly died in the desert because I didn't understand the desert and I hadn't prepared properly. I didn't understand that it's surrounded. Death Valley is surrounded by mountains. It's a big basin. It wants to be a lake. The sun won't let it be a lake. But when you get to the lowest point and you're walking there, there's just a thin salt crust. And the lake that wants to be there is lurking underneath in the form of hot mud. So it's like walking on crusty snow. You know, it almost holds your weight, and then you crash through. You go up to your knee or up to your thigh in this hot mud. Secondly, it's not the heat that kills you in the desert. It's not that it gets to be 115 or 120 degrees. It's the ground itself. The Indian word for Death Valley means ground on fire, and the ground itself has been measured at about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that if you fall down, you bake. And the very serious mistake I made was cracking through that mud, that salt crust in the mud, building myself a shelter from the sun. I walked at night and slept during the day, and left the wet, muddy boots on the ground on fire, which means they were baked into strange, cruel, unfoot-like shapes. And I had another 100 miles to go.
And your feet were pretty out of shape themselves by that point.
Yeah, the word tenderfoot occurred to me quite often.
I hate to leave Cahill stranded in the middle of the desert, but we have to take a short break. Then we'll return to our 1989 interview with Tim Cahill. This is Fresh Air. Tim Cahill, we left you with shoes that were baked out of shape while your feet were completely swollen out of shape in the middle of Death Valley. How did you ever walk the remaining mileage?
Well, remember back those strange little things on the sides of Buicks? They call them porta vents or something, little holes in the sides of Buicks? I made those in my shoes. I just took a knife and cut my shoes up and continued walking, and strangely enough, the human body is willing to accommodate itself to just about anything. I got so that I walked during the day. This whole trip took about 10 days, during which time I thought about taking things to various extremes and the worth of it, or the non-worth of it. I think we all start as travel adventurers. I mean, have you ever seen a toddler, of course everybody has, try to climb the sofa? The child falls down, cries, and a little while later gets up and does it again. Some of us learn our lessons, and we become postmen or buyers for Bloomingdale's or what have you, and others of us, myself included, just simply don't learn our lessons, and we keep climbing the sofa and falling down.
You know what I really related to in your story about Death Valley? You said that during the day, in the middle of the heat and sun, you'd say to yourself, I know I'd just be so happy if only I had some shade and something to drink. But then at night, when you'd have some shade and something to drink, there was so much more you yearned for that you still felt completely unsatisfied.
I think that's why people on spiritual quests go to the desert, because it jerks you around in your material wants so much.
Mm-hmm.
With the sun directly overhead, it's ugly. It's ugly. And as twilight deepens, it becomes absolutely beautiful. And what happens with there's a cycle of wants and needs. And with the sun directly overhead, all you want is shade and water. But as the world becomes beautiful, it expands around you and it shimmers around you in this wonderful deepening purple sensation. You want everything, and it truly gives you something to think about, and that's why I think that through the centuries, spiritual people have gone to the desert.
Well, you know, when you get back from the desert or from the rapids in the Himalayas or from some other natural extreme that you've taken yourself to, and you're home again in the comforts of home, how long does the exhilaration of the adventure last?
I think it lasts all your life. I've been talking about some of these adventures lately, and feel that every time I talk about them, I can feel them again. They're like photographs of friends or families that I can go through these little stories that I feel in my in my heart and in my mind and see with a visual eye.
Tim Cahill recorded in 1989. While he had yet another travel adventure last summer, he traveled to the North Pole on an old Soviet icebreaker. He's currently working on a book about his travels in the unexplored and uninhabited Ndoki Forest in the northern Congo. In case any of the mishaps endured by our travel writers have inspired you to roam far from home, you'll need some advice on how to keep your distance from parasites, funguses, and assorted bugs. Travel writer Paul Theroux has had them all. Last year, he wrote an article called Parasites I Have Known about the many afflictions he picked up in his 30 years of travel through the tropics. Paul Theroux told me last year he always leaves his illnesses out of his travel books.
I leave these diseases out of travel books because I don't find them particularly interesting to write about if I'm writing about a landscape or a place. To talk about your illnesses is really drawing excessive attention to yourself. The great place for writing about diseases is in fiction, in short stories. And in each of the diseases that I mentioned in my article, I have actually used for a story. For example, the one called Putsy Fly Fever, where the flies lay eggs on your shirt, and then they hatch, and the worms burrow into your skin, and then you have these worms in your skin. I wrote about in a story called White Lies, which is in a collection called World's End. Dengue fever, I wrote a story called Dengue Fever. Leprosy, which I haven't had, but I worked in a leper colony, I wrote about in a poem, and then in another story. So eventually, they find their way into print.
Why are diseases good for fiction?
I think because they're very, very dramatic, and when you think about the diseases that occur in fiction, like the plague, the Albert Camus novel, or the death of Ivan Illich, the Tolstoy short story, or Burnt Out Case, or I was recently reading a book called Christ Stopped at Eboli, and there's a lot of illness in that. It's just marvelous. I think because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's about mortality. But a travel book, when people write about their diarrhea in travel books or the illnesses, I don't think there's anything in it. I think people don't want to hear about it. And so I made a practice never to write about it. So I've never written about illnesses in my travel books. I think some fairly substantial books. But when I came to write an article about it, I saw I had a whole feast of, that's the word.
No, I think you were the feast.
That's true. But they are, I think also, to be serious, that when I went to Africa in 1963, when I joined the Peace Corps, I remember a professor, he was a science professor, I think a biologist, was lecturing us on tropical illnesses, and he said, he was describing, I think it was African eye worm, where it's really terrible because you can actually see the worm in your eye as it's sort of creeping across your eye, and that's how you know you have it. And he was describing snake bite and so forth. And he said, well, you're going to be off next month to Nyasaland, as it was called, Central Africa. And we said, yeah, don't you wish you could come? And he said, I wouldn't go there for any amount of money. And we said, why? And he said, it's it's full of insects, snakes, and he said, I just wouldn't do it. And he said, I'm staying in Syracuse, New York, thanks very much. And I thought, there are people who stay home because of illnesses, but I wouldn't dream of staying home because of an illness, since you can overcome or prevent most illnesses.
Did you ever have African eye worm?
No, I had my students had it. That's pretty terrible. You get it from swimming in certain stagnant pools. And the thing, one rule of thumb, which this is how you stay healthy, certain rules of thumb, never swim. Never swim in Africa is a good rule. Don't swim in fresh water anyway. Swim in the ocean. Another one is don't drink water. Don't drink unboiled water. It's quite an easy one. In India, don't eat meat. It's usually a good idea to keep to the habits of the local people. If everyone's a Hindu vegetarian, you'll be a Hindu vegetarian and you'll be better off. No one would be worse at cooking meat than a vegetarian.
Let me just ask you, this African eye worm, is it a hallucination that you're seeing the worm crawl across your eye, or are you seeing really a worm crawl across your eye?
Oh, no. There is a worm. The worm actually gets into your eye and it creeps across it. And it can be plucked out, but by a medical procedure. No, it's there. And the same thing is true with the worms that the putzi fly, they're called tumbu flies also, but putzi was the local language. They actually did, the fly lays its eggs on a shirt that's on the line. And unless that shirt is ironed, but with a very hot iron, the eggs hatch. They hatch with the warmth of your skin when you're wearing the shirt. And the eggs immediately, this is, you know, survival instinct of the little worm. Putzi means worm in Chinyanja. The worm gets into your skin and it stays there. It hatches there. So they have to be gotten out of your skin.
Well, you write about this in your article, and to me it was an image out of a Clive Barker story. I mean, you had boils all over your body. You popped one of the boils and a little maggot crawled out. I mean, I'd be mortified.
Yeah, my short story White Lies has it in, you know, more detail, but it's a grotesque thing to have. It's fairly painful when they're removed. They're not the boils themselves are just, well, they're boils. But it is terrible. It is terrible. But when you think about it, it's very dramatic and weird and the stuff of fiction. It's almost worth going through just to have something to write about. But, I mean, the same is true of most travel writing. Misery makes for good travel.
Travel writer Paul Theroux is my guest. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio in Washington with a word about what's coming up. In the O.J. Simpson hearing in Los Angeles, an expert testified today that blood sampled from the murder scene matches the genetic makeup of O.J. Simpson's blood. And it's said that fewer than 1 in 200 people would match up with that blood. We'll have a report from the courthouse and also a conversation with a blood specialist about what the tests can prove and not prove. We'll have an update on World Cup soccer, and I'll go shopping for the proper soccer gear. Spending liberally, you could be up around $1,000 to outfit yourself just to play the simple game of soccer. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Our archive show today is about travel and adventure. We're featuring an interview from last year with travel writer Paul Theroux about parasites and other bugs you can pick up in your travels. What do you do when you're visiting a place that you haven't been to before to find out what the local diseases and parasites are and how you can protect yourself from it?
I try to talk to somebody who's been there. And if I can't find anyone who's been there, I read as much as possible. I'm a great reader of guidebooks, not travel books, although I write them. I need hard information. For example, the scourge of the world today, I suppose AIDS is a scourge, but malaria is really one of the most serious ones, because malaria is very, very hard to prevent. And that's one, generally speaking, if you're going to New Guinea or Africa, parts of South America, lots of places. Not only is there a lot of malaria in these places, but it's of a particularly virulent kind. Other things you can prevent, venereal disease, you can prevent by simply abstaining. AIDS, you abstain. Lots of other things you abstain. But malaria, there's no amount of abstention can prevent it. So what would I do? I bought the best tent money can buy that has a mosquito net in it. When people in villages in New Guinea, and I was recently in Malawi, when people say sleep in the hut, you know, come enjoy your hospitality, I politely decline and say, I'll sit around and have a drink with you, but then I think I'll have my little tent. This is in a village. So carrying your little mosquito-proof tent with you is a very good way of doing it, and also staying in it after dark, getting up early, and because mosquitoes tend to bite in at night, in the early morning and in the evening, and not during the day.
Should this interview discourage people from going any place?
No. On the contrary, no one should not go to a place because they hear that they might catch something or that there's a prevalent disease. What they should do is read as much as they can about the place, consult a doctor, talk to people who've gone there, and then go. Illness, unless it's a bubonic plague, or the water is totally undrinkable, or there's some blight on the landscape, I can't think of, there aren't many things that would prevent me from going. You have to be very, very careful. But the fear of catching an illness shouldn't keep anyone at home. I think it kept people home in the past, but that shouldn't be the case. It really shouldn't be the case. We're smarter, and abstention and prevention can keep you pretty healthy.
Paul Theroux's latest book is a novel called Milroy the Magician. If you're traveling this summer, I hope you have a good trip. Me, I'm going home tonight and turning on the air conditioner. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our travel archive show was produced by Roberta Shirok with Nancy Greenlease. Assistance from our intern, Marcus Tossig. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.